It's the last talk of the day. Somebody can make it simple. Oops, disappeared. What happened? It was up.
Because it has to detect.
Yeah, it was once more. It was working only for one of them. Okay. Oh, yeah. That's gradually coming. I just think. Oh, no.
Not happy. It was okay.
No, I changed this page. It was okay in this mode. Okay, good. Yeah. I'll be very, very careful not to. Anyway, all right. So it's done by with the collaboration with people at Tennessee and Sendai, where I spend a little bit of time, and then with Weiha Wang, we have been collaborating. But several weeks ago here, we together made a very important discovery. So I'm thankful for KITP for this to occur. So I'll get to that at the end of the talk. And I moved to Tennessee because of this $1.4 billion machine called Spallation Neutron Source. And this neutron source really changed the experiment, neutron experiment, particularly in the inelastic experiment. Inelastic neutron experiment used to be very slow experiment. You know, just count rate is like less than 1 second usually. So we always say we don't need a computer, we just need a hand to count neutrons. Now, with this guy, we get 1.5, more than a gigabyte of information in a few hours. Gigabyte, so huge amount of data, because the spallation source gives a pulse source, and this is detected by many, many millions of pixels of detector in parallel, and each detector has a time resolution of a few thousand. So this creates a huge amount of data, and it's so huge that we still haven't fully analyzed the result. But anyway, it's very promising. So I'll show you some of the simulations rather than the result. We took data, but we're still counting. And we're just finishing a new building here. It's called JINS. We are moving into this building. And this will be a new center for science related to neutrons. So today, I'll discuss quickly about the dynamics of metallic liquid as we see it as an experimentalist, together with a simulation. And then discuss the nature of glass transition of metallic glasses. And after this discussion, we go to this jump in the specific heat at TG. This is the work with Weiwa. And finish with the X-ray diffraction experiment, which tells us something about the response of the structure to a stress in a nominally elastic region. So first, atomic dynamics. As you know, in crystalline state, we know the dynamics quite well. You define this dynamical matrix, and by diagonalizing this, you get an eigenstate, an eigenvalue. And a similar analysis has been done for liquids and glasses. However, it's important to note that this D is a time-dependent quantity in liquids. And early on, we had some discussion with I forgot who was saving me. Anyway, many of us are beginning to believe that at least high temperature liquid, diagonalization doesn't mean anything. It's really, you know, because this depends on time so much that there's no eigenstate, there's no normal mode, but something close to normal mode looks very, very different. So, we can see that by what we called dynamic pair density function. You know the pair density function, or G of R. And usually, this is defined as a static quantity. But in liquid, of course, it changes, right? So G of R actually has two definitions. One is the instantaneous G of R, that's the same time correlation function, which is given by X-ray diffraction. If you do X-ray, usually the energy resolution of X-ray diffraction is like few eV. So you're integrating over this atomic dynamics. So you're getting instantaneous correlation function. If you do neutron scattering, on the other hand, the neutron correlation time is much shorter. So effectively, we are integrating over only a few millivolt. So we are getting SQ0 by neutron scattering. And this difference is the dynamic information, okay? In a sense that if MTC cannot differentiate these two, then that's a bad news, because you just can't deal with the dynamic information. So this we can deal with by dynamic PDF. You know, so we get experimentally this SQ omega, as I said, in one shot with the spallation source. One experiment gives you huge two-dimensional, actually three-dimensional, SQ omega, and then by it's itself gives us a lot of information. But the way that we define dynamic PDF is that we transform Q into R, so we can get a pair density function of distance and energy, frequency. And if you do that for a high temperature liquid, it is done by Madhu Oja in the back. What you see is the G over R over omega, okay? So at high frequencies, this part is vacant, completely flat. There's no correlation. That means, you know, below 10 millivolt, this is about 3,000 of ion, so it's way, way above TG, more than three times above TG. Then you can see some correlations, sort of quasi-elastic correlations at low frequencies, but at high frequencies, you have nothing. That means that the high frequency atomic dynamics in this liquid is extremely localized to the nearest neighbor. It does not propagate much beyond. It's so strongly damped that it does not propagate much. So this is actually expected from our earlier result, because as I show you, I'll show you that this neighbor cage dynamics, not the atomic single atom dynamics, okay? Not a single dynamics, but the cage dynamics is, we have a good reason to believe that the cage dynamics is the closest to the normal mode. It's not a normal mode, but it's closest to the normal mode. The reason I say that is because that we have been studying this environment, in terms of atomic level stresses. This was defined a long time ago. This is primarily to define the topology of neighbors, right? The purpose is whether it is stress or not is not important. Simply that the force times distance gives you some measure of environment. And I have to show this picture every time, and many of you have seen many times, so I apologize for that. But the idea is, and indeed, some atoms are happy and some atoms are not happy, and that makes a difference. So we're trying to see, you know, who is happy and why. So, and this is primarily determined by the nearest neighbor, because, you know, if you just simply consider nearest neighbor interaction and expansion, around the minimum of a potential, and it just shows that the stress occurs because nearest neighbors are not sitting at the minimum of the potential. It's slightly deviated, and that gives rise to this atomic level strain and the stress. Strain cannot be defined without a reference, but the stress can be. So we use stress to define strain, essentially. So what it means is, for instance, this guy could be, you know, pressed by the neighbors, and then this will be under compression, even though the total stress, total force is zero. So we can tell whether which one is more compressed or sheared, and this tells us about the state of the atom. And this stress can be calculated by first principles, and we're doing that now, so that we don't have to set up complex effective potentials. We can directly do that for complex system. Now, the remarkable nature of this is that this, if you consider self-energy, okay, stress has six components, independent components. Pressure and five shear stresses. And if you consider, say, pressure and the self-energy of that, that's pressure and it's a bulk modulus, just divided by, so that's self-energy. And the shear energy, in the same way, you can define shear energy using a shear and modulus G. And as it happens, at high temperature, all of them follow this KT over 4, amazingly simple law. That means, you know, the total potential energy is three half of KT, right? And there are six components. So six components democratically divide this 3/2 KT into 1/4. So each one of them bear 1/4 KT, and times six gives you total potential energy of 3/2 of KT. So we tested this to various kinds of potentials, and remarkably resilient. It works every time. So we can use this as a basis for doing some statistical mechanics. Now, this is for high temperature, and if you extrapolate this to low temperature, it goes to zero. But that's not going to happen. Zero means everybody's happy. Okay. In real society, there's no way that everybody is happy because of the personal frustration and all that. And atoms the same way, because atoms get jammed up. So you cannot have in liquid state all atoms at the same distance. Yeah, you cannot do that. Only in crystals you can do that, but in glasses and liquid you just cannot do. So. Because of the jamming, it freezes into finite value. You know, there must be some minimum of the strain where below which the structure cannot be relaxed. Okay? It cannot go to zero. So it gets hung up somewhere. So to me, that is the glass transition. In other words, at high temperature, the system is dynamic. So environment is changing all the time. So in this case, the system can be described by continuous number, real number. But at low temperature, it sort of freezes into a very discrete environment. Okay? In terms of coordination number, for instance, you have to, at high temperature, if you time average, you can get fractional coordination number, real number. But at low temperature, you have to choose integral numbers, integer. So there is a very profound transition from continuous to discrete. I call this, it's like marriage. When you're young, you can have multiple friends, but you settle into one environment, right? So you gain stability by settling into one environment, but you get a little bit of frustration. So the question is, how much is the frustration? How much can you bear? So we found that there's a universal value of this frustration, which whether that happens at the TG. And therefore, the glass transition temperature can be expressed in a very, very simple way. And I'll get to that. But so this was tested for various kinds of metallic glasses, for which the data are available. And this is still being tested by other people, and the correlations are good. So here we are plotting KTG, normalized by bulk modulus and volume, and plotted against Poisson ratio. And the variation is only 4%. So the equation comes from that this equipartition theorem. So at high temperature, the each degree of freedom bears 1/4 of kT, right? But then it freezes at a certain value. So I simply assumed there's a universal volume strain, at which the system freezes. And this agreement means there is a universal volume, critical volume, which does not depend on details of composition. This paper lists all the compositions, and this covers everything, okay? A lot of different kinds of metallic glasses, metal alloys and metal and all that. So details of the chemistry is not are not important. So why do we have this universal strain at all? Universal strain means that the atom is sitting in some kind of the energy landscape minima. And if you deviate, too much, then at a certain point it falls apart. You have to go to the next one, right? Remarkably, at an atomic level, this threshold is well defined. And the reason is that because of discreteness, to me, a discreteness of the structure is a reason. You have to have some discrete numbers of neighbors, right? 11, 12, etc. But the ideal number may not be, there. So you have to choose either this or that. Okay. So that means that the environment of local free energy of the atom is minimum when this ideal value is equal to some integer. But in between, you have to have a strain energy. So you have a atomic periodicity of this local energy landscape. Very, very simple idea. Okay, so that means if you start with 11 and you change, say, for instance, the size of the atom, just a Gedanken experiment, then you have to go from 11 to 12 at the point where the strain is 0.5. Right? The strain corresponds to the correlation number change of 0.5. And if you do that, you can easily get critical volume strain of 11%. It's just elementary calculation. That means if you have a volume distribution, local volume distribution, like Voronoi volume distribution, beyond 11%, the system is unstable. That means you want to, for instance, this has too many neighbors, okay, and the volume is too big. So you'd want to eject one of them. And this one has too few neighbors, so it wants to attract another neighbor. Of course, they are trapped in the environment, so they cannot do it. Okay, they cannot do it, and therefore they are unhappy. What they want to do and what the environment allows are not the same. That's why they are unhappy. So I call these unhappy atoms as a liquid-like atoms in which the local stability is not ensured, and these guys as solid-like atoms. Co-engressed kind of ideas. And then you can calculate the fraction of this liquid-like atoms as a function of temperature. And then I say that if it gets to the percolation concentration, the system freezes. So that our minimum strain is strain which corresponds to the percolation concentration of this atomic level strain. And that turns out to be 24%. So this gives you a universal explanation of TG. Now let me change the gear and then go to discuss about this jump in specific heat. As you know, that the specific heat makes a jump at TG, and this has been discussed in terms of relationship to fragility and etc. And because it varies from one system to the other, some systems shows big jump, and like GO2 shows a small jump. Now, several weeks ago, Wang wrote me in a paper which was really remarkable, because he and his colleague found, for metallic glasses, okay, that's this yellow one, for metallic glasses, the values are the same. Okay, delta CP does not depend on composition. It's all the same. And I have this simple theory that local self-energy is equipartitioned to KT. That means, total potential energy is 3/2 of KT, as I said, right? But then it freezes to a constant value at TG. Okay, that means at TG, there must be a jump in the specific heat of 3/2 times Boltzmann constant. Very, very simple law. So we looked at the data, if that is the case. And lo and behold, it is. It is quite amazing that for metallic glasses, it's just in the unit of KB, the specific heat jump is 1.5. I feel like a 19th century chemist. It's amazing that such a thing had been left untouched. The reason is that it's not easy to measure specific heat for metallic glasses, because usually the system crystallizes during the measurement. You have to go way above TG to measure this accurately, and it now became only possible today. So it is amazing that it has never been done. Some of the other ionic ones are close, but many of them are below. Now, this is specific heat per atom, not molecule, okay? Molecule. I'll come back to that point. And also, we did quickly an simulation. I forgot to put in the simulation.
So you think that you don't have any more even wear energy in the glass?
Wear energy?
In the glass, you still have vibration.
Of course, of course.
You're still activating some
potential
energy.
That's correct. That's in B, in bulk modulus, okay? But end of the day, equipartition function equalizes everything. Yeah. Okay? Sorry? Right, I'll come to that. So, sorry if I didn't put in a simulation, but the simulation also really shows 1.5K. Okay? So, why not why atom rather than molecule? Sorry?
Why?
So I think that the best way to answer that is to write CP as 3/2 KB divided by some kind of N, where N is the number of atoms in the mobile dynamic unit. So metallic glasses is truly an atomic glass. So what it does mean is that metallic glasses are truly atomic glasses. There may be some, sometime it might appear like molecule, but when it comes down to the dynamics which determines TG, it is atomic. That's what it means. So N equal 1 for these metallic glasses and some of the ionic glasses, and smaller number for polymers, because the units are larger than the atom. So, for instance, for boron, that's an experimental problem. This is a pure selenium, and it's not easy to measure, to make it really. Yeah, that's why. I have my doubt about the experimental accuracy of this guy.
Sorry, but you also should also have only fraction of the 1.5, How come you can be? So in your model, you have this parameter.
Yes.
The number of, so you would expect that delta CP.
Yeah.
Is the thread line, or the thread line divided by 2, or by 3, or something?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. I mean, for instance, in B203, okay, B203, this number is 503. So that means only oxygen is active, and boron, which is lighter, is a high-frequency lighter. So they are not contributing. So, for molecule, I we thought that they might apply, this may be equal to number of atoms. No, it's significantly less than the number of atoms. That means the molecules are not integral hard sphere. Okay, it has an internal degree of freedom. So effective N is smaller than molecule. Now, half a century ago, Wunderlich had a similar idea. And he tested this for various models in which he called Bs, like CH3 or something. He arbitrarily identified some kind of unit of a molecule. And he showed that it is close. But he remained here and never expressed this in terms of KB. So I did, and lo and behold, it's again very, very close to 1.5 times KB. So after this paper, everybody started to say that, no, delta CP varies from one system to the other. So this paper was forgotten, but I'm now resurrecting this. Now, at the end, quickly, that diffraction experiment, it's a long story, so I'll make it short. Essentially, that if you apply stress on the metallic glasses, the system becomes anisotropic. So you cannot use the usual PDF analysis anymore. So we use spherical harmonic expansion, which are related to the Bessel function, and et cetera. If you do that, you can really see anisotropy in the pair density function. And this anisotropy should be proportional to derivative of the isotropic one if the deformation is totally affine. That means, uniform strain and everything. And but it is not. There's a deviation. So on the other hand, that if you do some anelastic measurement, this is so-called creep measurement, then you can see this differences. So you can explain the total. This is due to bond orientation order. You can explain the total in terms of this elastic plus anelastic. And if you do that, elastic portion is about 80%. And 24% is anelastic. So this 24%, if you recall, is exactly the percolation concentration that we used in calculating PG. That means these are unhappy atoms, and these are happy atoms. So at the end, and also this equivalence, maybe I'll skip this equivalence, temperature and stress. Collapses, but so we have very simple view for about the structure and dynamics of the metallic glasses, and based upon this equipotential function theorem at the high temperatures, and from that we deduced this TG value. I don't think it's easy to get numerical or quantitative value of TG, and this came out without almost no adjustable parameter. We increased the percolation concentration from static to dynamic a little bit, but other than that, there's no adjustable parameter at all. And then this, again, specifically jump, okay? This jump is much bigger than, say, anticipated by Adam Skip's theory, and probably we can say something about that later. And then this fraction of unelastic sites. So these three experimental support came completely independently. And when I wrote this paper, the referee said, this must be an accident. Now, three accidents together make the case a little bit stronger, I think. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Takashi. Questions? Comments? Thank you. If my understanding is correct, the glass transition temperature is probably cooling rate dependent.
Yes.
So if we have very different cooling rates, the transition temperature could be different, and the final glass state may be trapped at a different fictive temperature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if your cooling rate is very fast, the state could be relatively unstable and more liquid-like.
That's right.
Which part in your model is associated with this cooling rate?
So that is correct. But here, the scale, you know, is from zero, okay? So if you change the cooling rate, you can change TG maybe a few percent, right? In the real scale. And this is the accuracy of plus minus four. So yes, within this, there's an effect of fictive temperature. But all these glasses are bulk metallic glasses, which were cooled at a rate of, you know, maybe 10 degrees per second or something, similar rate. So they are within the band. Yes, you have a very unstable glass. Yes, this would increase. No, that'll adjust this population concentration.
So that curve for the glass transition temperature, the key, as I understand it, is that there's a universal value of critical strain that goes back to your reorganization of number of nearest neighbors.
That's right.
But shouldn't, I mean, how does the fact that the structure in metallic systems is so variable, right, including the number of neighbors around different atoms and things like that, is that?
No, it's not that variable. You know, that always in metallic glasses, nearest neighbors are close to 12 and 13, between 12 and 13. So it's this one, okay, it's not that much variable. So,
but
and this approximation dependence comes from this equation. That's
right. But this critical value of strain.
Yes, that's the critical.
Remind me again how that is related to the topological number of nearest neighbors.
So essentially, this is the crux of the matter. That we define the critical volume strain to be 11%. If a house is too big, it's going to collapse.
But where does the 11% come from?
Come from this. For two dimension, it's easy to think. For instance, if you have a one atom surrounded by the same atom with a different size, right? A atom in the center, surrounded by B atoms, all neighbors are B atoms, right? And then you're going to change the size of A and B. Just a Gedanken experiment. And if A, RA is equal to RB, you have six as a happy number. And if you increase RA, then you go from six to seven, to eight, etc. Right? So if you change the size, you go from one ideal environment to the other. And you can do the same for three dimensions. So this equation was deduced heuristically. But you know, details don't matter. I mean, that miracle improved this and also a little bit, but details are not important. Essentially, there's an ideal coordination for a given size of A and B, which increases monotonically, right? And so that's the line. So this number continuously increases as you change the size. However, real coordination is discrete. So that's this step is all about. So if you change the size, you have to make a jump. That means there's a minimum strain you can tolerate. You know, beyond that, beyond which the environment somehow would to respond to reorganize. That's the point. So I use this value of 0.5 as an input to calculate this minimum strain, volume strain. It's a very straightforward geometrical argument.
A couple quick questions about your delta CP correlation.
Yeah.
Could you put that one back, please?
Sure.
Um, the metals, are they all both metallic glass, or do they also include the some of the older, like gold, silicon, also gen data?
Yeah, I think so, right? The composition, yeah, it's palladium silicon is included, right?
But gold silicon was the one that...
No, not included? Okay. Not included.
The reason I ask is that, of course, that drop is going to be rate dependent, right? Depending on where you go out of equilibrium, is going to affect that to a certain extent.
A little bit, yes. Yeah.
But
not much.
That's why the ones that will be quenched at 10 to the 8th are going to be looking different from the ones that you quench at 1 degree a second. Right?
Not much. Actually, it goes like this, all right? So this peak depends on weight.
Right.
But we are using this slope to define the change.
So that also takes.
So that's a question matter. In fact, because before, until recently, that you could not go about much above TG. So measurement was done mainly for this peak. But now we can go way above this peak to measure the what we believe is the real.
Okay, that also takes care of the annealing effect if you come from the
yeah, exactly.
So it's, and the selenium data that you're
and if you cool down, I'm sorry that I didn't bring the simulation, but if you cool down the simulation, it goes like that without this cap, this peak.
The other question was that cloud of polymer data that you have there. Is there any structure in this by size or by type?
Well, this is too recent, so you're welcome to analyze that.
More questions, comments? Yes, Alexei.
Takeshi, we know that jump in CP is very big usually in hydrogen bonding system.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how they will look like in this plot?
Maybe you know, maybe you can tell us.
I don't know.
So, in terms of the picture that you have with the TG related to the local strain and the Poisson ratio, I guess I'm struggling a little bit because I always think of those two things as somehow related to each other, that how much strain you've somehow trapped in the material is going to affect the elastic response, and that you're talking about strains on a very small scale where I'm not sure looking at the macroscopic elastic properties applies anymore. So I'm just wondering how you reconcile those things.
Right. This comes from the Escherby factor, indeed. So we're using continuum approximation for atomic level strain and to calculate the tail beyond the secondary nearest neighbor. It is amazing that it works. But in simulation also, we checked whether that is the case. And with beyond the nearest neighbor, this continuum approximation seems to work quite well.
Other questions, comments?
Yeah.
Is there any connection here and between what this idea is and yet the deer is? I wanted this to be a half a sentence question. Is there any connection between your observation, your idea here, and what Dürer is talking about? Again, a very simple correlation with elastic properties and local elastic energies.
I think there is. It's a bit more here that we have this factor. I think it's maybe a little bit beyond, but conceptually very similar. Yeah. But he did not put this equation down, right? You know? I don't think he wrote this down. So conceptually related, but I mean this is much more explicit. Much more explicit, and also that I calculated this value quantitatively. So that's the difference.
Any other comments? Okay, I don't see anyone, so let's thank Takeshi and all the other speakers of the stage.